I once knew a deacon in a Baptist church that I went to who was a little bit unstable, we'll say. When you saw him, you never really knew what you were going to get. He was known for getting up on his soapbox and he would start ranting about the book of Revelation and the flag and the end times. More than once, he went off on a tirade against the pastor because of some rumor that he'd heard that week, and most of it sounded like the ramblings of a madman that made no sense, really. More than once, he started to preach at the other deacons about the blood of Jesus and needing to get things right and repenting so that God would heal our land. You really never knew what he was going to do or where it was going to come from. He was a bit of a loose cannon. But the other deacons, they saw all of that passion. And they remembered this story about Jesus in the temple, and they figured that all that passion must be the zeal for the Lord. So they decided to make him the chair of the deacons. Yeah, and then in his new role, he went on a witch hunt. He began chasing demons behind every curtain, holding secret meetings, trying to get rid of the pastor. When it came to light that his accusations were actually all based on false rumors and lies, he turned his passion to another staff member of the church. He wanted to have his witch trial one way or another. He was set on turning over tables because he was pretty sure that he was a prophet. What he refused to see was that the tables that needed turning were his own. Jesus walks into the temple one day and starts turning over tables himself, and yes, it is a bit more than just disruptive. Jesus is causing a whole scene here, and everyone starts wondering what in the world is going on. So at first they all jump back, and then a moment later over the speakers of the temple, you hear, we got a code yellow on aisle 9, and the temple authorities, they come running over. What sign can you show us for causing all this mess? Or as we might put it today, what's the meaning of all this? What sign can you show us? It's a good question, you know. Because people there, they're just going about their normal worshiping business in the way that it's been done for generations. You see, if you live like, say, way up in Galilee, and you wanted to come and make your annual pilgrimage to Jerusalem for the Passover, and you wanted to make a sacrifice, it really wasn't practical to bring your goat or your sheep all the way from Galilee, all the way down to Jerusalem. It might get attacked by a wolf or something along the way. So instead, what you did at that time was you would sell your goat back home in your own town. And then you just carry the money with you so that then you could buy an offering there at the temple gates. This was really practical. It's what people had done for generations. It's really not what Jesus is mad about on this day. So why in the world does Jesus lose it? What is the meaning of all this? It's an important question for this story. For one thing, there are way too many folks like this deacon I once knew who see their own anger reactions and outbursts in Jesus' actions in the temple, and they just assume their anger is righteous anger, just like Jesus's. So the first thing we need to know about this story is that this isn't just some angry outburst from Jesus. This is planned protest. And the two, they aren't really the same at all. I mean, when you study the other accounts and the other gospels, it's pretty clear Jesus is not just going off his rocker here. He's actually being really intentional. He's thought this thing through. And so he enters the temple that day knowing exactly what he is about to do. See, the people traveling from out of town, they weren't the only ones who were buying their sacrifices at the temple gates that day. As normal as the status quo had become, that process of buying and selling, it had also become the system that was starting to oppress the poor and the unclean and the marginalized and the outsiders. But to understand that, you really have to understand the theology of the day. You see, their theology believed, they thought that, you know, if you were poor or if you were suffering in some way or if you were kind of a marginalized outside kind of person, it probably means that you did something to sin against God. See, you were actually getting what you deserved. It was your fault. It was your sin had caused your own suffering. This is the theology of the day. And we'll hear that again. It comes up in John chapter 9. Some of you might remember that story where the man is born blind, and Jesus' disciples ask him, "So Jesus, is this man, was he born blind because of his own sin or because of his parents' sin?" Now, I'm not quite sure how you can be born blind because of your own sin. I don't think of a lot of sinning happening in the womb. But that was their theology. That's how it worked in that time. And of course, that kind of theology, it sort of sounds crazy to our ears, right? I mean, we know that's not how things work. Can you imagine blaming a blind man for his own blindness, blaming a victim for their own suffering? I mean, could you imagine telling, "Oh, I don't know, someone who was raped, well, you really shouldn't have been wearing that." I mean, could you imagine telling, "Oh, I don't know, someone who only was able to eat a meal when they got it from the school lunch and whose single parent worked late into the night at a dead-end job and so they had to take care of their little sister every day before and after school. Well, you really should have worked harder in school and gotten better grades so you could have gone to college and then you wouldn't have to work a dead-end job at minimum wage." Hard to fathom that, right? I mean, could you imagine telling, "Oh, I don't know, someone who was brought to the U.S. at age 5 with illegal status, well, you shouldn't have broken the law. Now you have to pay for your crime." Was it the blind man's sin or his parents' sin that caused the blindness, Jesus? Who's at fault here? That's how the theology worked in that day. If you were poor or sick or suffering or marginalized in any way, it must have been some sin you committed. I'm glad we've come so far. But in that time, in order to make things right, you had to go to the temple to make a sacrifice. Making a sacrifice at the temple, it's how you got back in God's good graces, and it's how you got back in the good graces of the society. But chances are most people, they don't have the right animal for the right sin, so you had to purchase one. And that purchasing, you know, it just happened to be a little bit of an ironic coincidence that your purchase was starting to line the pockets of the religious and politically powerful of the day. This is all part of what's happening in the temple. It's just part of the system. It's how things worked. And most people, they didn't actually think about it like that at all. It was just normal. I mean, no one set out to do something wrong, but the temple had become this system preserving the status quo between the powerful and the marginalized. A system counter to the kingdom of God that Jesus is always talking about. A system counter to God's desire and dream for shalom, for wholeness and flourishing of all people and all creation. And truth be told, it's not how most people thought about the temple. Like I said, they just thought about it as it's the holy place where they went and worshiped and made their sacrificing. They just sort of did their thing, not asking too many questions at all. But Jesus has this funny way of looking at the very heart of things. He sees beyond the concrete surface and starts to recognize the patterns. And one of the things that Jesus does again and again is challenging us to look deeper, to see things that we'd rather not see, to see things that make us a little uncomfortable. You see, back in John chapter 1, in the prologue of John's chapter, the introduction of this whole story, we're told that Jesus comes full of grace and truth. And last week at the wedding of Cana, we encountered the fullness of Jesus' grace, a grace where new wine comes and fills our deep emptiness. But this week in the temple, the very next verse, the very next story here, we're encountering the fullness of truth. Jesus challenges us to see what we tend to ignore. And he does this in all kinds of ways throughout his ministry, but here in the temple, he does this by turning over tables. It's another one of the signs, John says in verse 23. This is not some flash of anger. It is planned protest. Shocking protest, yes, but protest meant to wake us up and to help us see what's right there in front of us. To help us see that the status quo is not okay with our God. You see, there's a fundamental difference between reactionary anger and anger that fuels a fire in us to act courageously in the face of injustice. There is such a difference. A difference between reacting and subverting the power. But just like that deacon I told you about, when we are reading about a protest here on the printed page, we often confuse the two, one for the other. Have you noticed that? Whether we're reading about Jesus' protest here in the temple or we're reading about protests out in the streets, we often misunderstand what's going on, assuming people are just sort of reacting. And so we sit, maybe in the comfort of our own living rooms, making judgments about other people's intentions without looking deeper and asking, what's the meaning of all this? We tend to assume that maybe they're just getting worked up, just reacting to one incident, one shooting, one ruling, one president, and ignore the whole power systems that they're actually trying to expose and subvert there. We're missing the very possibility, that maybe the protests in our streets just might be, maybe inspired by Jesus' protests in the temple, which was most certainly inspired by the protests of the prophets in the Old Testament. What is the meaning of all? Can you show us some sign, they ask him. It's a good question. It's a question we should always ask when we come across a protest, because our first impression is probably wrong. Shoot, our second impression is probably wrong too. I mean, did you notice how that happened actually to Jesus here in this story? Jesus answered their question, "Tear this temple down, and I will rebuild it in 3 days." And they thought he was talking about literal bricks and mortar. But again, he's trying to help them see something, to see beyond the surface of things. He's trying to help them to see that what they came looking for there in the temple amongst all that was going on, they could actually find in his flesh and blood. No money required. He was trying to help them see that the heartbeat of God was pulsing through his veins, because if they could learn to recognize God in him, then maybe they would be able to learn to recognize God that's pulsing through all of creation, coming to them, coming to everyone, clean and unclean. This is our third Sunday in the Gospel of John, soaring up on this eagle to see the horizon beyond the concrete in front of us. And today, we can't get away from this troubling reality that the one who brings grace is also the one who brings truth. You see, when we encounter the fullness of God, we will always encounter both grace and truth. They come to us hand in hand, one with the other. And the honest truth is, if we want to keep going on this journey with Jesus, and if we want to see more of what he wants to take us, and if we want to taste his grace, it means we're also going to taste a little bit of truth along the way. Which might mean, it will mean, there's going to be some tables that are going to need to be overturned in each one of us. John ends this part of the story here by writing, Jesus would not entrust himself to them because he knew all people. He knew what was in every one. Jesus can see. He knows what's in every one of us. He knows the tables that are cluttering our heart and getting in the way. And so I wonder, If in the next few moments as we prepare for communion, if we might be brave enough and courageous enough to invite Jesus to come and turn over the tables in our hearts that are cluttering up our own souls. And the tables that we're so used to, we don't even notice them anymore. Those tables that are just sort of maintaining the status quo and getting in the way of God's dream for the world and even God's dream for our own life. Jesus, he knows what's in you. He knows what's in me. He knows better than we do. So let's invite him now to do that work in us. Will you pray with me? Holy One of God, we do confess there's much that we don't really want to face in our life. And there's much about the status quo that we're comfortable with. So we ask that you might forgive us for trusting our dreams for this life more than your dream for us. And forgive us for ignoring uncomfortable truths that we don't like to look at. And help us to trust your grace enough to allow your truth into our hearts. In the silence of this very moment, invite us to see what tables need turning over.